Hello and welcome to Feeling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the grease on my gasket. It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Feeling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, my greasy gasket, how are you, mate?
I'm very good, thank you. Yourself?
Do you know what? Yeah, I'm on good form. Yeah.
Excellent. Listen, I'm excited about this one. Not that I'm not excited about these episodes generally, but I'm particularly excited about this one because this man is part of my guilty pleasure. That's all I'm going to say.
Oh, hello.
To give you another idea, when my missus goes to bed, normally about 10, 10:30, this is when I have my little binge, right? And no, it's not Cindy from Babe Station. It's somebody very different from the world of television, but it's my guilty pleasure.
Ah, oh, well, that's a great little precursor to my intro. So our guest today, well, he's a gentleman who could just about be the ultimate petrol head. He started off life as a car dealer from South London, and 40 years later, well, guess what? He's still a car dealer from South London. But he's also a TV presenter, a motoring journalist, a producer, a campaigner, and probably the ultimate wheeler dealer. It is, of course, my great mate, the one and only Mike Brewer.
Hello, boys. How are you?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
What an introduction. I love that.
Well, it's all true, though, isn't it?
It is. It is genuinely all true.
I'm just really nervous about being David's guilty pleasure.
I kid you not, Mike. Genuinely, because I've watched you so much, especially of late, and maybe it's been a lockdown thing and a post-lockdown thing, but I feel almost starstruck talking to you because I watch you on the telly every night.
Oh, thank you, Dave. I feel starstruck listening to you.
Yeah.
Because nobody's ever seen you. Let's face it, but we all know you.
This is true. This is true, and probably best that way. But no, listen, it's a pleasure having you on. And yeah, we just wanted to sort of talk through your motoring past, your motoring present, your motoring future, anything to do with cars, because as we say, you are the ultimate petrol head, the ultimate wheeler dealer.
Now, see, my time on this planet Earth, I've spent an awful lot, me and Mike together, working, having fun. So I'm not going to tell any stories, Mike. I'm just going to tee you up because there's some brilliant stories. And the first one that I want Dave to hear, because it is just, you know that film Sliding Doors?
Yeah.
Where something happens and it unlocks the future.
Mm.
Tell us, tell Dave, tell the listeners about how the TV career kicked off.
So it kicked off in a really bizarre way. I was at my car dealership, which I shared with another guy called Dave, and it was in South London. And I'm belting along. I'm doing fantastically. I've got great product range. I'm knocking cars out left, right, and centre, and I'm just happy. You know, I'm with Michelle, my wife, and I'm just happy. It's all going well. And one day I was, it was my day off.
Yeah.
But being it's my day off, I can't help myself. I went to the car auctions. And on the way back from the car auctions, I just stopped at my car site just to swing in and check in with Dave to see if everything was all right. And as I walked in, Dave was sat behind his office desk with a, I can only describe a, somewhere between brown and green. I don't know, what's that, puce? Yeah. But he was somewhere between those colours. And as I walked in, I said, "You're right, Dave." And he said, "No, I had a really bad curry last night and I'm just about to explode." So so I grabbed the phone. So he ran off into the toilets. And as he ran off into the toilets, the phone rang.
Mm-hmm.
And it was his phone that rang, his dad's phone.
Yeah.
And I picked it up and it was a lady from Channel 4 called Celia Taylor looking to make car programmes. So he's in the crapper having a crap, and I answered his phone.
and that's where it started.
And that's where it started. It's kind of an odd one because she asked me there and then, she said, "Look, you know, I'd love to get, you sound great on the phone." She said, "Tell me about a Golf GTI." I told her about the Golf, thinking she was a punter. She went, "Actually, I'm ringing from Channel 4. You sound amazing." I said, "Well, it is my job. It's what I do. You know, I sell cars." She went, "Can I come down and see you?" And I said, what, you know, do you want a test drive?" And she went, No. I work for Channel 4. I'm coming down. I want to talk to you about being on a car show." And I went, "Do you want to buy the car? That's what I'm doing. I just want to sell her the bloody car." Anyway, I said, no, I'm not interested in doing a car show. And she turned up the next day with a little handheld camera. And she said, look, I'm the girl that spoke to you yesterday. My name's Celia. Please, please, please. I'm going to lose my job if I don't go back to some film. Please give me just a little bit. Just walk around this car, Peugeot 205 in the dealership, GTI. She said, walk around it and just tell me about it. It's all I need you to do. Just tell me. Go for it. Go on, you do it. So I sort of walked around the car and told her all about the car. And then she folded the screen. She went, oh, my God, you're amazing. You have to come in for a screen test. And I said, you got no chance. Look at me. I've got 60 cars in stock. I've got a business left, right and centre. I'm working hard. I've got time to come in and do any TV stuff. He said, no, please, please, please. Come in and see us. Anyway, I said no. She gave the tape to her bosses. Her bosses said, he's the guy. She then phoned me up together with another guy who's a big, massive producer these days called Zad Rogers. Mm-hmm. They phoned me up and said, please, would you come in for a screen test? And I said, look, genuinely, it's not for me. I can't help. However, take my number. And if you need any assistance while you're making the show, like if you want guidance about what you're looking for and what you're doing, just phone me. I'll give you guidance for free, but I just can't do it. So the show they were making was in 1997. So we're going back 25 years now. Yeah. It was on Channel 4 and it was called Deals on Wheels.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an insight into people buying and selling their cars. And what they wanted was a car dealer to show how he bought and sold cars.
It's great, isn't it? Isn't it just, just mega, isn't it?
And they then phoned me over the call. So the next few months, I get a phone call from somebody in the production team saying, Austin Maestro. And I go, no, bang.
It's always a no.
W2002TII. Yes.
Yes.
I want one of those. That happened over the course of a few months. And then after a few months, they stopped ringing. That was the end of it. And it was actually 3 months later, I can remember the day, me and Michelle always remember this day very clearly. I was moving my sister in her house down in Hastings. And we was moving the furniture. My phone rang and it was a great big 8,500, you know, car dealers.
Like a brick.
My phone rang and it was Celia Taylor. And she had to remind me who she was. I'd completely forgotten about her. And she said, no, I'm a girl from Channel 4. You know, you come down and done some film. And I said, oh, I'll remember. She said, we've made the programme. We've done it. We've made it. And I went, oh, that's brilliant. That's great news. Well done. She said, but now we've made it, we want to change it. We now think we want it hosted or linked together by an authentic car dealer rather than a TV presenter. And I said, right. She said, please, will you come in and just screen test for that? And I said no again. I come home that night and discussed it with Michelle. Yeah. And Michelle said, why don't you go? It's a bit of a laugh. Just go. So a few days later, I ended up in a mock car showroom in East London. together with a full film crew, which I've never seen before.
Yeah. Wood panelling walls, I hope, in the office.
I think it was basically a carpet shop that they'd pushed the carpets out, moved some cars in. And I walked into this fake car showroom and they had an MG Midget and a Nissan Bluebird. And the guy said to me, the director said to me, okay, we've written some notes for you, or you can just wing it. And I said, I don't want your notes, I'll just wing it. And he said, just tell us everything you need to know about an MG Midget.
Yeah.
And there was a huge, great big camera with this little cameraman called Hamish behind it.
Yeah, Barber.
Hamish Barber.
Yeah.
And he said he popped out from behind the camera and went, action. First time I'd ever heard that in my now new professional TV career. I looked up at this room full of people thinking, I'm never going to see these people ever again in my life. Never. And I don't know what, I'm so out of my depth. I'm not a clue what I'm doing. So I just said, right, MG Midget, if you're going to go and buy one of these and you want to get the price down and you need to know how to get the price down on Midget, it's the simplest trick in the world. Just put the person who owns the car in the passenger seat on the test drive, and when you drive it up the road, just swing into a car wash. Just put
it through. Is that right?
Put it through a car wash with them sat in the passenger seat and watch you drive that price down, because that car, well, you'll be soaking wet by the time. I said a lot more than that. And then the other one was a Nissan Bluebird. And I don't know if you're old enough to remember what they
were. Yeah.
Free box saloon.
Yeah.
And I said, so the Nissan Bluebird, I said, is it a fine car built in Sunderland, or is it the car that you want to see when you fall out of a nightclub at 2 o'clock in the morning?
In Sunderland.
with a plastic bag with a magnet aerial on the boot lid. That is your taxi that's going to get you home. It'll always be a trusty Nissan Bluebird. And everyone was laughing. I just remember all the shoulders going up and people are chuckling and everyone was laughing. And I went around did a lap of the two cars. And at the end of it, they just said, you've got the gig. It's yours. Yeah. The show's yours. You have to do it. It's your show.
And did that turn into Driven, Mike?
No, that turned into, that was Deals on Wheels.
Deals on Wheels.
So then what happened to get to Driven? So that was in 1997. We started to make it. I got the princely sum of £200 per episode.
Very good.
Let me just take that in.
I tell you what, it's more than we get now.
That is champagne. Right, £200 an episode. But I did 5 days in a car showroom in Catford, and it was 5 shows. Mm. By the time it got to its 3rd episode, and don't take my word for this, you know, but look it up. By the time it got to its 3rd episode on screen, it became Channel 4's highest rated factual programme in their history.
Is that right?
Yeah, so immediately my phone rang from loads of people, but namely this very bizarre guy, JP knows him very well. I don't know if you interviewed him, Dave, called John Bentley.
I do know John Bentley because I did a gadget show thing with John Bentley. Well, he's a very, very nice man. He's a slightly odd man, but he's a very, very nice. Eccentric.
I'll give you chapter and verse how this went down. It was brilliant. Mm. So John Bentley phones me and said, hello, yes, no, is it, yes, no.
That's him.
No, yes, it is. No, it is me. I'm John Bentley, yes, that's me.
That is him.
I'm phoning you up because I'm the producer of the BBC, am I? Yes, no, yes, I am. BBC, is it Top Gear programme? Is it Top Gear? Yes, it is. Top Gear programme. And I'd like to meet you. And this show is in its 3rd week on screen, and he said, I'd like to meet you. I've got a proposal for you. So I met him. Me and JP have drunk in here before as well. I went and met him at the Falkland Arms in Great Tew.
Right,
yeah.
And I remember walking into this pub. Remember, it's my 3rd week on national television. Mm. And I sat down in that window seat. I actually went there recently to reminisce about this. I sat in the window seat, and John Bentley came in and introduced himself to me and sat opposite me in the window seat. And it's like I paid somebody to do this. But the guy at the bar turned around, walked over with his copy of the Sun newspaper, threw it down on the table and went, sign that for me.
Is that right?
It was like I paid for it. And I was it looked so fake. It was unbelievable. Because it was as John sat down and I thought, that's a bit fake. Anyway, John said, and you have to remember when this is 1997. Mm-hmm. John said, do you ever watch Top Gear? I said, yes. He said, Jeremy Clarkson, the main host of the show, is leaving. And this is the first time Jeremy left. Mm-hmm. He said, Jeremy's leaving. And we, the BBC, would like to offer you the first 8 minutes of the programme. I'm sitting there in the pub thinking, Jeremy Beadle, here he comes.
Yeah, 80 minutes. Right?
And that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, oh, they're going to write, I've been had over here. And I said, I beg your pardon. Sorry, mate. What? And he said, we'd like to offer you the first 8 minutes of Top Gear. And I said, well, I just don't know what to. I mean, I literally was flabbergasted, didn't know what to say. So I did a proper car dealer's trick here. I thought, well, you know, take the guy's details. We had a little bit of light lunch. I took his details. We spoke about, you know, like two dogs sniffing asses in the park, doing nothing. And then I left him and I phoned Tim, all names that JP's going to know. I phoned my boss at Channel 4 then, a guy called Tim Gardam. And I phoned him up and said, look, you put me in this position doing the show. I'm working for you at Channel 4 doing the show. And you put me in this position. I've got the BBC now knocking on my door. What do I do? And he said, who's the guy at the BBC? Who's the guy at the BBC? And I told him. And when I got home, I put it into an email, very early email. I think it was a MySpace back then. Put it into an email and I sent it, his details to him. And I did an old car dealer's trick. I just sat back and I watched two fight. They just wanted to have a fight over me. And the result of the fight was that Channel 4 offered me a 5-year handcuff deal and promised me another car show to rival Top Gear as part of that deal. And there was the creation. The following year, I did another series of Deals on Wheels. And then we've started to form the creation of Driven.
So now, Mike, obviously, Wheelers Dealers has a new incarnation in terms of dream car. For those that haven't seen it yet, describe the concept.
Okay, so I did a few different series of Wheeler Dealers throughout the years. I did a series called Wheeler Dealers Trading Up, which is where I took just £300 and I traded my way around the world. I did it a couple of times, traded my way around the world to see if I could get to in the first episode or series, I got to a Porsche 911 convertible in Dubai.
From 300 quid start.
300 quid. In the second series, I got to a Ferrari 348, which I bought in Lake Como in Italy. and that's genuine. All that was absolutely for real, nuts out, genuine. It was the most excruciating, terrifying thing I've done, other than going to Afghanistan. But
sorry, just pause for a second. For those that don't understand the concept, so in other words, each one of these deals, the margin obviously goes into the pot. So you start off with 300 quid, you then make another 500 quid, you got 800 quid and so on and so on and so forth.
Correct. And the idea is across, because I've only got eight episodes, across those eight episodes, I literally, and I kid you not, Dave.
Hold on, Mike. From eight episodes, you went from 300 quid
a Ferrari 348.
Mate, you're a good car dealer, aren't you? Jesus.
You just touched on something there, Mike, and I was going to ask you, because unlike a lot of TV programmes, I'd imagine, whereby as the presenter, a lot of the work is done by the production crew, the researchers, the producers, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors goes on TV. We know that. And a presenter will turn up in a chauffeur-driven car and be handed the script and kind of like, oh, what am I doing now? As if they've done a lot of this. But because of the nature of what you're doing and because you need to have that knowledge and you need to have those contacts and whatnot, is that you can't do that with these shows. Like, genuinely, you and Elvis have got to be working throughout the week doing this. And when you finish filming, you must still be doing parts of these different deals to get there at 7 o'clock at night or 7 o'clock in the morning or now. But you know what I mean? It's real, isn't it?
It's real. And, you know, if I've had a phone call from Elvis at 1 o'clock in the morning in the workshop and JP, Nick Avery, our cameraman, still holding that camera up after, you know, 35 kilowatt camera on your shoulder for an 18, 20 hour day. And he's still standing there shooting Elvis steady hand, putting a bolt in an engine at 1 o'clock in the morning. We've done it time and time and time again. And once we say to these people at the beginning, I'm going to get your dream car. I've said it.
Yeah.
You know, it's out there. It's out there for the world to hear. So I can't go back on that. And we do have a team of people, but fundamentally the actual work comes down to me and Elvis. That's what you're coming down to.
We have to,
you know, it's me that's up in Scotland and moving to Huddersfield. And you know what production's like, Huddersfield to Bristol. There's only one inch on a map. So, you know, when you finish filming in Huddersfield, you can stay in your hotel in Bristol. And I'm going, do you know that's 7 hours away? No, you can't. On a map. Anyway, so you know what that's like. And I live that life 24/7, 6 days a week.
And interesting enough, you know, there's a big thread here, cars, all the way through your life. But there's a bit of a departure in 2010, wasn't it, with this Frontline Battle Machines. Tell us a story about that amazing Chinook, which... Well, you know what? Dicing with death just doesn't cut the mustard.
If I told you this story, you're going to think I am Baron Munchausen. I'm telling the tallest tale in the world, right? But I sat on a train from Oxford to London to go and do voiceover for Wheeler Dealers, which is in Trident Studios in London. And I sat on a train and people had left their Metro newspapers everywhere. So I picked one up and the headlines of the newspaper that day was... And it was a, dare I say, a blacktop newspaper. I think you know which ones I'm talking about. You know, the world's going to end, crisis. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was one of those newspapers. The front page said, Mum goes into JJB Sports and buys her son American body armour to centre him on the front line because we can't protect him. And as a taxpayer, and I'm a proud British taxpayer, and I pay a lot, I read that in disgust, and I was quite angry about that story. And I shouldn't be, but I was. I get to work, I do my voiceover, and then Ed China turns up to do his voiceover a little bit early because he's got a meeting. So I'm kicked out the voiceover booth and told, take a stroll for an hour, hour and a half, and then come back and you can finish off your voiceover. So I wandered round Trafalgar Square, and I'm staring down Whitehall, and I thought, well, I'll just walk down Whitehall towards Big Ben. So as I'm walking down Whitehall, I passed the MOD building on my left-hand side with two big statues, two policemen standing there with their guns pointing towards the ground. And as I walked past, the policeman went, all right, mate. And I just turned left, and I went, how are you? And I just walked straight past them and straight into the door of the MOD.
No.
And I went up to reception, and it's plate glass window at reception with a little wee speaker in it. And the lady said, can I help you? And I said, yeah, do you have a press officer? She went, well, do you have an appointment? I said, no. She said, well, I'm sorry, you need an appointment. I said, well, you must have a press officer, though. She went, well, yes, we have, but you need an appointment to see the press officer. And I said, well, can you phone your press officer and tell him Mike Brewer from Discovery Channel is in your reception? And she went, well, not really. I said, go on, just do it. I'm here. You might as well. I don't want to waste my time. Anyway, she picked up the phone. She said, go and sit down. So I sat in this marbled hallway. Right. She then said, gestured me up to the speaker. I went up back up to the speaker. She said, Lieutenant Colonel Stratford Bright will be down to see you shortly.
Wow.
And then this door opens, or not a door, it's a series of doors, they're glass doors, and this guy walks in it, and he then goes for a sniffing machine, a radar machine, a scanning machine. He then walks out and says, Mike Brewer, I love your shows, I watch your
No way, get out.
What are you doing here? And I said, I need to talk to you. I said, I've got a bit of time, and I was so angry about a newspaper report, I need to talk to you about it. And he went, come in. Take your belt off, leave your phone, leave your wallet, leave it all there. Sniffing machine, scanning machine, radar machine. You walk into the atrium, they've got a blooming Starbucks. You know, you walk in, there's a Starbucks in there, literally. So I walk in, sit down, and we have a coffee. And I said, about this headline. And he said, let me explain the headline to you. He said, in the front line of Afghanistan at the moment, he said, if we're going to make new body armor,
yeah,
is what we do. He said, we will make it, we will tool up and machine it in one size, like for the majority of the army. Mm-hmm. So if the majority of the army is medium, we're going to tool up and make it for mediums. And that all gets put in a container, goes out there, container doors open, all the medium soldiers go and get their body armor. Then we're going to tool up for small, then we're going to tool up for large. However, when the guys get their mediums, you always get the soldiers that are large or small, that the body armour don't fit them, they're always going to moan back to their mums and say, they've got his new body armour today, but I didn't, you know. I'm likely to get killed in my body armour because they've got new stuff. And so that was the story. So I said, well, why don't you just tell that story? Why don't you tell that? And he went, we're the MOD, nobody's going to believe us. He said, why don't you tell it? And I said, well, I can't tell it. How can I? He said, you're Mike Brewer. You can tell that story. Everyone will believe you. And I said, how can I tell it? And he said, we have just made the large body armour, plus we've got a brand new tank, and they're on their way to Afghanistan in the next couple of weeks. Why don't you go out there with it? And I went,
Whoa. Easy, Tiger.
Easy, Tiger.
You're thinking that's more dangerous than Catford.
I'm coming here as a disgruntled taxpayer, and he went, no, it's a bit like, you know, Bob Hope when he did the Second World War. Or he said, Jimmy, what's his name? Jimmy's been out there. David Beckham's been out there. He said, lots of people go. And if you went out there to have a word with the troops and cheer them up, do a bit of speech with the troops, he said, let it go down the storm. Plus, you could tell that story. And I said, well, I don't think so. And he said, let me write it out for you, what we can give you, and see if you can sell it.
Having a quick two-minute chat with a copper. Now you're left in the building. Now you're walking out with a gig and you're off to Afghanistan.
Correct. Right. So I then sent that email to Discovery Channel. And I said, I've been offered the front line in Afghanistan for a series. And they said, pack your bag, make the series. So I produced it with my own company. We did 10 episodes, spent 3 months with Nick Avery, my cameraman, on the front line in Afghanistan.
And you got shot down in Bravo November, didn't you?
Yeah, so Bravo November, which has now just been retired to Cosford, which is an amazing airframe. It's got the most amazing story, the helicopter.
This is the big Chinook, isn't it?
The helicopter that was our sole surviving helicopter from the Falklands War, first into Grenada, first into Iraq, first into Afghanistan. This helicopter is a hero.
This one and only helicopter did all of these things?
All these things. Wow. So that sole surviving helicopter from the Atlantic conveyor, it took off the Atlantic conveyor in the Falklands in 1982. It took off, flew away to go and pick up an engine, and the Atlantic conveyor got bombed and sunk. So when it flew back, there was no ship to land on, and everything, all the Chinook fleet, the Harriers, everything went down.
Yeah.
So we got one helicopter. That's it. So we started the campaign in the Falkland Islands with Bravo November, this one helicopter. Right. So I end up in Afghanistan, and I'm going to cover the story of what they call a medevac, which is a flying hospital.
Yep.
I don't know about Bravo November at this point, by the way. I don't know about this helicopter. But I'm out on the pad in Camp Bastion filming this big green Chinook helicopter. Mm-hmm. And the guy, the loadmaster, has got me and Nick in the back, and he's talking to us about, this is the surgery, this is the fuel line, the drip lines, this is where we do triage, this is where we do major. And as he says it, the alarm goes up, and he looks at me and Nick, because the crew are running scramble. Yeah. The crew are running to the airframe with the ramp down. We'd have to walk off with our light, our camera, me, And he looks at us and he says, sit down. So we both just sat down, and then this crew arrived. The helicopter was in the air in 30 seconds. It was already turning by the time they got
Oh, my God. So and, you're off on a proper job.
So we're off on a mission, and we should be there. We should be there. So the helicopter flies off, and then it's we can hear on the radio. We all plug into the, they'll put helmet on, and we can plug into their comms, and we hear on the radio. It's actually Americans that have been pinned down in a firefight. They've run out of ammo, more or less, but they've administered all their medicine. They've got no more medicine to administer, so they were in urgent need of help. And unfortunately, the Americans couldn't go and get them at that time. They couldn't go and rescue themselves. So the RAF scrambled, and they said, he actually said, Ian Fortune, Chomper the pilot, he said, guys, this is the mission in front of us. This is what we're facing. I am the captain of this airframe. If anyone's got a problem with me going in to do this, walk forward right now. And nobody did.
I mean, you speak over that, but that's some moment, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Mate, honestly, it was. I mean, the hair on the back of my neck now is standing on
end. I bet. Mm.
Presumably, I mean, you were twitchy. You were proper twitchy.
At the moment, it could have been we are just landing in the field, picking up medical evacuees and flying away. Yeah, so I'm kind of looking at Nick, who's now sat opposite me, and just being a TV presenter, here we are, we're on our way to a mission. I'm in this, look at everyone. They're getting the bloodlines ready. The plasma's getting ready. You can see them going through the kit bags. And at the back of the helicopter, I've got four RAF soldiers just checking their ammo and checking their guns. And I'm saying all this as a TV presenter. And then the helicopter started to do some really violent, wild manoeuvres, which were evasive manoeuvres. And then I'm starting to think, okay, we're evading something here. We're being shot at or something's happening. Oh. And then the captain, Ian, said, okay, we're going in. And then he descended the helicopter so fast. And then that's when it became real, because the back doors open.
Yeah.
And then there was cordite, the smell of gun smoke, just come washing into the back of the airframe.
Oh, my God.
And as it landed in this field, the helicopter landed in the field, the four soldiers at the rear exited and took rear covering fire. And behind this compound wall, which was probably about, I don't know, 50 metres away, broke this very sorry band of people, you know, with bandages around their head, two of them carrying stretchers. Unfortunately, there was one terminal on the stretcher.
Oh, God.
There was another guy that had his leg blown off on the stretcher. And coming across this field, and that's when all hell broke loose. That's when the world just lit up, and there were rounds coming through the airframe. There was a round come under my seat.
What?
It was just bullets flying everywhere. And you ding, 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 through the helicopter, and I'm like, you know, what's going on?
You must have genuinely feared for your life at that point.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm like, this is it. You know, it gets worse. The story gets worse, David. So I'm thinking, bloody hell, this is it. Because when they got to the back of the helicopter, the soldiers got tangled up on the rear machine gun that's mounted, and one of the straps from the stretcher got caught on it. So they all backed up. And as they backed up, they sort of went around the side then and tipped this other guy onto the helicopter off the stretcher. And as they tipped him on, it's actually caught on film, he gets shot in the back.
Oh, my God.
It's horrible to watch. And then everyone basically piles on board. The helicopter pops into the air. You can't believe how quick they are, these Chinooks. Mm. It pops into the air, and we're away. And I say, we're away. I can't believe it. We've just been in a full firefight. But everyone's done an amazing job.
See, you're still doing pieces to camera at this point. I mean, God, get a grip of yourself, man. Why didn't you have a meltdown? I would have been sucking me thumb.
Google might brew a Chinook after this. Anyway, the helicopter's away, and it was this weird moment as the helicopter was about 30 seconds into flying away, and I've been in an aeroplane with JP where he's pretending to lose zero gravity, where he's done that with me a couple of times in the plane. As the helicopter goes away, exactly that, JP's trick of zero gravity, there was a bang like that, and then the whole helicopter just dropped. And as it dropped, everything and everybody in the helicopter just lifted off the floor about a foot.
Yeah.
And then everyone went back down on the floor. And everyone looked at each other, and we all knew at that moment something had gone wrong, something drastic had gone wrong. There was a massive vibration through the helicopter, and that's when our pilot, Ian Fortune, burst on the radio and said, "Chaps, I've been shot."
He was shot in the head? What was it?
Yeah, he had 10 rounds come through the airframe. One went through the cockpit. It came up and hit, believe it or not, the NV rail on his, the night vision rail on his helmet, smashed, the bullet smashed open, and then the round ricocheted down and come through his cheek and out the other side. Then the rounds continued up and went through the hydraulic lines and embedded itself in the front gearbox. Now, me and JP know, if you shoot the gearbox of a car, it's going to stop. Mm. Right? It just stops. But this Chinook just chewed the bullet up and just carried on going.
Yes, I love that. Bit of breakfast.
He then says, when I've interviewed Ian Fortune after, he then says, at that moment, I knew I've been shot. The hydraulics are leaking all over the cockpit. The airframe's got a round in the front gearbox. We're in a mess. So yeah. He calls Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. And as he calls that, he says, I was looking at places to crash land. I'm thinking, I'll crash land there. That looks a smooth bit of desert. Meanwhile, in the back of the helicopter, I'm thinking, this is how I go out. I'm going to be ensnared on a desert floor in Afghanistan, stupidly reporting on this thing because I bothered to walk into the MOD, you know, more months ago.
In Whitehall, yeah.
Because I was angry. Anyway, he then said, I thought I'd crash land there. And then he went, oh, no, there's a much better bit of desert there. I'll crash land there. And then he went, oh, that bit's a bit smoother. I'll crash land there. And by the time he'd sent it three or four times, he could see Camp Bastion on the horizon. And he thought, do you know what? I'll crash at Camp Bastion.
I'll have a go.
Yeah, so he crash landed in the hospital car park.
Oh, my God.
I mean, he's the fourth helicopter pilot to win the Distinguished Flying Cross since the Second World War, and Ian Fortune got him, had his investiture at Buckingham Palace, where he invited me along to see him get his investiture. And it was, he deserves every bit of credit. He saved 21 souls that day. Unfortunately, one passed, but he saved 21 souls, including me and my crew. And it was not until I got off the helicopter, I looked back at it and see all the holes over it. It's all on the documentary. That this big turret with a big black BN on it came into view. And it was the first time I went, BM, Bravo November, Bravo November. And an engineer standing next to me said, that's effing Bravo November. And
no,
I said,
way.
What does that mean? He went, that's our helicopter. It's the most historic helicopter in our fleet. And then I went back to my tent. I had to go and see a padre and get a, you know, get a debrief. And then I went back to my tent. You get an hour of internet every night.
Yeah.
And then I Googled Bravo November, the heli airframe.
Yeah, yeah.
And I found this amazing story about it. So I wrote another documentary for Discovery Channel called Bravo November.
Were you also thinking that if we get those holes patched up, there's going to be some margin in this helicopter?
You know what? I'm kicking up, mate.
Yeah. Oh, no, I could trade this out to a Learjet.
I'm kicking up, right? Listen to this. So the next day, we thought we'd go round to see the helicopter, go and film the bullet holes and go and see it. So we went round. It was still in the hospital car park. So we go round there, and the engineers say they can't fly it. And they say, we can't fly it. Why? And they said, the hydraulics are knackered. They're stiff. They've got fluids gone. And they said, Ian, it's a 14-ton helicopter. Ian, it must be pure adrenaline alone that gave him the super
power to,
fly it and to land it, because it's impossible to fly. Anyway, 2 days later, we're filming somewhere else on Camp Bastion, and this Chinook's dropping, you know, cannons off and going back and dropping cannons off, and Nick turned the camera and zoomed in on it. Bloody hell, remember?
It's up in the air again.
Up in the air again. Off it goes to work. And it's been serving, it's been serving this country for 40 years. 40 years, that helicopter.
Amazing. Quite, amazing.
And do you know what? This is a show about, you know, your car history. And here we are
talking about
getting shot at in Afghanistan. Unbelievable, eh?
Well, it is unbelievable. But we do need to talk cars, Mike. And we need to take you back to the very beginning. We always ask everybody, first car, what was it?
Little mini, ear and a beige, GJJ 550J, little mini 1000.
There's another one who can remember the reg.
Pretty much everybody that we have on here can remember all of the registrations of all of the cars, especially the first one. The first one's always special.
First love, isn't it?
It is. It is. So where does it go then? What's the car history? Talk us through roughly from the mini. Where do we go?
Okay, so I was 16 when I bought my mini 1000. Drove it illegally until I was 17.
You little tinker.
Yeah, put L plates on it, still drove it illegally, I think, at that point. Maybe had my brother sat next to me once or twice. Loved that car, went everywhere in it, and parked outside my sister's house. Her neighbour reversed into it, dented it. The insurance company gave me 300 quid for my 300 quid Mini, of which I repaired the dent with my dad, put Mini lights on it, painted the roof black.
And it went out for 500.
Not so great.
No, wait, shut up.
So I sold it for 800 and I went, I just earned more money than my mum and dad in a month in one deal. So I'm going to do this again. So I bought a Morris Marina Coupe.
Nice. Oh,
hi, girls.
Hey. Hello, Mike here.
Which I gave 600 quid for. Spent an awful long time with my dad, flattening and polishing it, putting new wheels on it, seat covers, all that kind of stuff, tarting it up. I drove that around for a few months, and then I sold that for 1,100 quid. Mm-hmm. And that was it. I just thought, I'm quite good at this, buying and selling cars.
Yeah. That's ultimately where it started then. Yes, so actually, your love of cars or your interest in cars actually spawned your entire occupation. Because you thought, actually, I'm quite good at doing this. I'm making a bit of a margin each time. I just keep going and going and going.
Yeah, I knew an awful lot about cars at that age because my dad was a well-known car customizer.
Okay.
I'd spent years and years in the workshop with him. And, you know, like a reluctant kid, when your dad's saying, look at that paintwork, son, you know, you can see it's been oversprayed. You're a reluctant kid. Yeah, all right, Dad. But my brain has an ability to soak information and store it and park it. And all those years later, all this information was there and I just knew what was right, what was wrong. And I still do today, thanks to those years, you know.
It's important grounding, though, isn't it? Because obviously when you're doing the shows and obviously you're doing up cars, and while it might be Mark or it might be Ed or it might be Ant that are actually doing the greasy work, but for you to have that background knowledge, at least in terms of what's going on, is important.
It's vital, you know. Yeah. The team rely on me on a daily basis to come up with why we're doing this car, what's the backstory behind it, what's important about the marketplace for this car at the moment, what are the usual jobs that you would do on these cars that the audience may face. Can you make a part or do you have to buy a part? Is something repairable and fixable or do you have to get it off the shelf? And a lot of that comes from this brain of mine. It comes from me. But, you know, there are other people around me as well. When I give the information, they scurry off and find out if it's for real or not. But... no, it's my passion. I don't know. I honestly don't know any different. Look at my books. Like, these are my library. My library is just cars. And that's all I know.
I think I know the answer to this, Mike. And it was when you mentioned before about having something in stock. Are you somebody that personally has a lot of cars, personal possession cars at any one time, or is everything for sale to an extent? Is there a Mike Brewer garage and then is there a Mike Brewer trading garage? Are there two separate things or is it a sort of fluid motion?
Right. So my car dealership, Mike Brewer Motors, obviously I've got thousands of cars in stock. It's a high volume seller. We sell 600 cars a month. That's a big business and that's our business. But I do have a private collection of cars. If I love a car, I love it, and I'll love it and love it and love it, and I'll obsess over it. So things like the Citroen SM that I restored, a beautiful green one that was recently featured on the Grand Tour. They used it on the Grand Tour at the end, the green one on the Surrey Downs. That's my car. I bought a Ferrari last year, and I bought loads of stupid things. However, I've got a collection of Porsches. So I've got things like a 1952 550 Spider. I've got a 69 2.2T, which is a hot rod. Mm-hmm. I've got a 74 912. I've got a 82 SC, but that's now a hot rod, like a GT car. I've got lots of Porsches, and I can't seem to let those ones go. But the others, I had the most wonderful, beautiful Lotus Cortina, 1965 Mark I Lotus Cortina, full restoration. I had that... I bought that sort of 2 years ago. But I don't know. I can walk into the garage, and I've got this lovely garage, and I can walk into the garage, look at the cars, and just on the flick of a button go, I'm selling that, and I'll sell it. I'll just sell it.
Well, it's your mentality, isn't it? It's the dealer in you.
It is.
And the wheeler dealer.
Once I've got that to sell it, I will then obsess over selling it. All my focus of attention is what I want to get that sold.
But will it be replaced by something else? In other words, is the personal fleet, does it always amount to a certain number? Is it 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, whatever? In other words, if you kind of go, right, do you know what? That's going. The one in the corner's going. I've made my mind up. Are you then going to scratch another itch to replace it with something else?
Yeah, well, I've got a 5,000 square foot building up the road and it will suck 40 cars. So I'm always looking to to buy a car and to keep it and love it and cherish it and in some respects enjoy it a lot. And then I do a lot with my cars in terms of the Sporting Bears and other charity organisations. Once I've had my thrill with the cars, they can be enjoyed by somebody else. They can go on and live with somebody else. I sold the SM.
Oh, did you?
I sold the Cortina, the SM, the 360. I actually bought John Cooper's Mini Cooper, which I bought. Yeah, and then I ended up, because I've got another Mini Cooper, which is my car, I ended up selling the John Cooper car. That was kind of a special thing to
And have. Tell me, you've gone to the dark side, haven't you, in that you're driving an electric mobile, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I bought a Taycan.
Magnificent, aren't they?
It's stunning. Don't blame me, but blame my accountant. He phoned me up and said, spend some money on an electric car. Go and buy it. You can write it off against your tax and go and buy it. And JP and me know that the best electric offering out there at the moment in terms of quality fit finish and performance, he's most definitely the Taycan. So yeah. I would have bought one of those. Although saying that, I've seen that new Lotus launch last night.
It's nice, isn't it?
It's lovely. I would imagine Colin Chapman's turning in his grave.
Oh, he won't be happy.
He's probably spinning up to 10,000 RPM at the moment. I said at lightness. I said at lightness, not make it 2 tons.
Oh, he'd be throwing all of that away, wouldn't he?
He would be. But the point is, for Lotus to survive, they have to adapt and move. And I actually like it, and it's going to be sub 100 grand.
Yeah.
And it's going to have 360-mile range, which is better than the Taycan. Yes. It's an SUV, and I might switch out into one of those in the not too distant future.
It's a pretty looking car, isn't it?
Yeah,
Mike, I've got a tough one for you here. Of all the cars you've ever owned, you need to pick one and one only. This will be a nightmare for you, and you have to stick with it for the rest of your life. Which one is it, and why?
It's my 90. I got the answer immediately. It's my 1964. Austin Mini Cooper S.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
One car.
So you can keep your Ferraris and your Lamborghinis and your Porsches. There is not a single car ever made, produced on this planet, ever since or will be, that gives you the same connectivity as a 1960s Mark One Mini Cooper S. Yeah. It's a absolute thrill ride from start to finish. If your listeners haven't driven one, haven't experienced it, please do once in your life. And the reason why I love it so much, it was always my dream car. It has been since I was a lad. I always wanted that Cooper S. And I've never been able to find the right one. So I eventually did. You know, a few years ago, I was fortunate enough to find the right one. And I did a full nut bolt body restoration on it. And it's now a 2022 1964 Mini Cooper S. It's amazing.
I bet it's mint, eh?
It's brand new. Yeah, it's brand new. Yeah.
So here we go, Mike. Music and cars, they go perfect together. So we need a fantasy drive. What are you driving? Where are you going to, and what are you listening to?
Okay. I am driving on Route 1, California, on Big Sur.
Yeah.
In a 1964 Mini Cooper S with my beautiful wife, Michelle, sat beside me and cranked up full volume on the radio is The Who, Bubba O'Reilly.
Oh.
We've got an image now, haven't we? Yeah. We've got an image, a beautiful image of the sea in the background, this beautiful little car with the sun just glinting off the paintwork.
Oh. Minna lights on, 3-in-1 exhaust, jobs are good.
Do you know what? It doesn't get better than that, I don't think. And on that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out.
I could sit here and talk all night long. It's been great, hasn't it? So anyway, look, unfortunately, that is it for this week's Fueling Round, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, a big thank you, but a huge thanks to our great friend, my buddy, the one and only Mr. Mike Brewer. Thanks, pal.
It's an absolute pleasure. Please have me on again. We'll carry on the other stories.
We've got so many, haven't we? We've got like hours and hours and hours.
Oh, yeah.
We can do a Mike Brewer trilogy, I think. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you've liked what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening and, we'll see you soon. Ta-da.